Hello and welcome to the Emmanuel Croydon podcast. At Emmanuel Croydon, we exist to be a community drawn together by our desire to know and follow Jesus. We long to become disciples of Jesus who are equipped to serve him in the whole of life, transforming families, communities, and workplaces as we love God with heart, mind, soul, and strength. We hope you enjoy this week's talk from the evening service. Thank you for joining us today. Grace and peace to you.
So in the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. From the roof, he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "Isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. She had purified herself from her uncleanness. Then she went back home. The woman conceived and sent word to David saying, "I am pregnant." So David sent this word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And Joab sent him to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab was, how the soldiers were, and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." So Uriah left the palace, and a gift from the king was sent after him. But Uriah slept at the entrance to the palace with all his master's servants and did not go down to his house. When David was told Uriah did not go home, he asked him, "Haven't you just come from a distance? Why didn't you go home?" Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my master Joab and my lord's men are camped in the open fields. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? As surely as you live, I will not do such a thing." Then David said to him, "Stay here one more day, and tomorrow I will send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. At David's invitation, he ate and drank with him, and David made him drunk. But in the evening, Uriah went out to sleep on his mat among his master's servants. He did not go home. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it with Uriah. In it, he wrote, "Put Uriah in the front line where the fighting is fiercest, then withdraw from him so that he will be struck down and die." So while Joab had the city under siege, he put Uriah at a place where he knew the strongest defenders were. When the men of the city came out and fought against Joab, some of David's army fell. Moreover, Uriah the Hittite died. Joab sent David a full account of the battle. He instructed the messenger, "When you have finished giving the king this account of the battle, the king's anger may flare up, and he may ask you, 'Why did you get so close to the city to fight? Didn't you know they would shoot arrows from the wall? Who killed Abimelech, son of Jerubbaal? Didn't a woman throw an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died in Tebez? Why did you get so close to the wall?' If he asks you this, then say to him, 'Also, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead.'" The messenger set out. When he arrived, he told David everything Joab had sent him to say. The messenger said, "Come out against us in the open," but we drove them back to the entrance to the city gate. "Then the archers shot arrows at your servants from the wall, and some of the king's men died. Moreover, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead." David told the messenger, "Say this to Joab, 'Don't let this upset you. The sword devours one as well as another. Press the attack against the city and destroy it.' Say this to encourage Joab." When Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. At the time After the time of mourning was over, David had her brought to his house, and she became his wife, and she bore him a son. But the thing David had done displeased the Lord. This is the word of the Lord.
Rebecca, thanks so much. I wonder what stories you shared with one another. The one that that came to my mind this last week was back in 2002, the Football World Cup quarterfinal. It was England versus Brazil, and we lost agonizingly closely. Sorry, I know there's some Brazilians in the room, so well done. 2-1, and it was very close. And it was happening over in Japan, South Korea, so early morning here, and our school said, you know, you can come in early, watch it at school, and then go out. Now, the double agony was not only did we lose, but then we had to go out to an exam. So I was not frankly very pleased. And there was this sort of wooden sort of door separating the area, our kind of form room area from the main part of the school, and sort of got to go through this gate. And so as we went for the gate, I just kicked it in frustration. And it was sort of old wood, and the wood shattered right through. So I thought, well, I better fess up. So I went to my form teacher, but kind of as I approached him, I thought, well, maybe if I just sort of mask it in some way, it won't sound as bad as what I've just done. So as I got there, I sort of stammered out some words, some completely ridiculous thing about my foot slipping in some way as we got to... Anyway, he saw straight through it, and as you can imagine, the problem was compounded. I'm ashamed to say my initial mistake compounded by the lie. Now, this evening, we're thinking about the story of a gigantic cover-up that Rebecca's just read for us, and the effects of this sin, this cover-up, they form the background to Psalm 51. It will be a well-known psalm to a number of us. We're going to use some of the words of it later in the service as we come to communion. But this evening, we're going to look just at that passage that Rebecca read that forms the background to the psalm. Now, just to give us a little bit of context, 1 Samuel, the book just before this, is all about the failure of Israel's first king, King Saul. He fails. He doesn't live as the Lord intended for the king of his people. And so he says, look, I'm going to raise up another king, King David, my anointed king. And in this first half of 2 Samuel, up to this point, just before this chapter, we've been given this model of David, a model king. A model kind of godly ruler. He accepts the mantle that God gives him of leadership. He steps boldly into it. He humbly begins to lead the people in God's ways. He leads them in prayer. We see his godliness. We see how God promises that he's going to be with him and that there's going to be someone on his throne forever, he says. The Lord gives him great military victories. And then we're just a couple of chapters before this, we see something of David's real compassion as well, and humility, a love for those on the margins. So he's been held up as this great spiritual leader, God's own anointed king. And then here in chapter 11, it all comes spectacularly crashing down. And as readers, we're meant, I think, to be left thinking, how does it come to this? How is it that we've seen 10 chapters of this godly ruler step into the mantle of leadership, and now it's come to this? How could a man of godliness and integrity now stuff up so badly? And the answer to that question really is an answer that is going to be helpful in its own way for all of us this evening. The answer to how you can fall so far is the human heart. The human heart. Jeremiah chapter 17 verse 9 says, the heart is deceitful above all things. Who can understand it? Now perhaps you don't think of your heart like that, but I think this is the thing that connects this ancient story to us here this evening. Through this story, the Lord is, I believe, I pray, going to show us something of the tendencies of all of our hearts. that are like David's. Now, the passage as it does that is going to be slightly uncomfortable. It's going to expose our hearts. Now, when the Lord does that, his word is full of different things. It's got the encouragements, it's got the comforts, it's got the challenges as well. And when he exposes our heart, he always does it not to leave us feeling beaten up, but to leave us reshaped, shaped more in his image, more in line with his glorious, his good purposes for our lives. So that's what I pray he's going to do for us this evening. But he'll do it through a bit of making us think about our hearts. And here's the first way that this passage addresses what our hearts can be like. It's in the first four verses. They show that sin takes root in us the more we let it in. Sin takes root in us the more we let it in. If you've got the passage still, look with me at the first four verses, or Jono will have it on the screen. In the spring, at the time when the kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem. Now, sometimes people latch onto that comment, David remained in Jerusalem. Ah, here he is. He's abdicating his responsibility. That's not what is happening here, I don't think. Actually, in another part of 2 Samuel, his men say to him, don't go out to battle. If you go out to battle and get yourself killed, where are the hopes for the nation? God's placed his authority, his hopes in you. So he's not gone out, not out of a sense of kind of abdicating his responsibility. That's not what's going on here. But what these verses are doing is giving us a stark reminder as we see what happens, that the sort of slippery slide of sin, that if we open the door to temptation, often that grows. You open the door and it's become spiritually dangerous. So let's sort of think our way into David's situation. So he can't sleep. So he gets up. He's walking around the walls, the roof of his palace. The palace higher than all the surrounding buildings. And so while others couldn't have seen Bathsheba, where she was bathing on the roof of her house, David could see from that vantage point higher than all the other houses. Now, we can't fault David for spotting that. He's just walking around the roof of his palace. There's no sort of sense in the passage that he's deliberately kind of going around to sort of try and catch a look. He just happens to spot her. That's not the issue. The issue is that he lingers. He lingers. He doesn't look away. He spots her, and then he stays there. And he stays there a bit longer. You see the slippery slope of temptation begin? Several opportunities for him to resist in the coming verses, but at each point he allows himself to be drawn further and further in to the sinful desires of his heart. That's because his heart was like ours. Different ways, but we'll see. Hearts in which sin takes root, the more we let it in. So first for David, it's the lingering look. Then it's sending the servant to find out more about her. Then it's using his position to summon her to his presence. I mean, who can resist the summons of the king? And now she's with him in his private rooms. Still an opportunity for him to turn back. And again, a moment, giving in to his desires, using that power imbalance to sleep with her. Now, lest we're in any kind of doubt about what's going on here, in verse 4, when David talks about sending messengers to get her, the Hebrew literally says, he took her. He took her. No sense of her will here. It's rape. Now, at this point, many of us are thinking, we're just struggling to identify with this because maybe it's just so outside of the experience of the sin in our lives. Maybe we're thinking that this just isn't me at all. I've never done anything like this. Now, that may well be true. But in this chapter, remember, we are getting a little picture, a picture of the tendencies of all our hearts. Different sin, but often the same downward spiral when we let sin in. Because if we're honest, we know, don't we? Once we open that door, it becomes increasingly difficult to resist. And I wonder where the rubber hits the road of that for you. Whether you could ask yourself this evening, as I have this week, where in my life am I particularly tempted? Where am I tempted to open the door to that sin? just think, what are the situations for you where temptation particularly is present? And maybe like David here, it's late at night. Or perhaps, as for me, I've sort of been thinking this week, when I'm tired and irritable, that's often when I struggle to stay gracious, tired and easily allowing myself to stew on things. Maybe it's like that kind of time for you, or it's when you're bored, or whatever it is. Ask yourself that question. When is it for me that I particularly struggle and that I just need to be careful about not opening the door? You see, sin takes root the more we let it in. And so there's an encouragement from these words. Try to not let it in by the help of God's Spirit, to avoid the places and the times where we're most tempted. That's the first thing we see about our hearts. Here's the second. This passage, it addresses this tendency that we all have, the tendency to cover up. And it says to us, covering up sin leads to more sin. Verse 5, David gets the unwelcome news. The woman conceived and sent word to David saying, "I'm pregnant." And he spots at once the danger of him being exposed. Immediate thought, how do I protect myself? How do I keep this quiet? And so he hatches the plan. He invites Bathsheba's husband, Uriah, back from the battlefield. He's pretending that he wants an account of the war. He could have easily got that from others. The first sort of step in this web of deceit that he builds up. Verse 8, he says, go down to your house and wash your feet. He sends a gift with Uriah, ahead of Uriah, probably a food and drink for him to enjoy with Bathsheba back home. Now you can see why he wants to get Uriah home for the night. He hopes that, you know, this is, I don't know whether this is sort of colloquial expression in the day, but he hopes that he's going to do more than washing his feet, yeah? And that 9 months later, no one will be any the wiser. The baby was Uriah's. That's the thought process. Unless we're in any doubt about that at all, look at what Uriah says to David when David asks him why he doesn't go home. Verse 11, Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel are staying in tents, and my commander Joab and my lord's men are camped in the open country. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and make love to my wife, lie with my wife?" Different versions say, "As surely as you live, I will do no such thing." So Uriah knows what David was asking about why didn't he go back home. Well, he's asking, why didn't you go back to the loving intimacy of your wife? You're back for one day. Why wouldn't you go? That's what David wanted. And so he tries again at a different tack. This time, verse 13, getting him drunk. And again, it fails. So just step back a moment. We have rape. We have deceit. Then it's getting Uriah drunk. All to try and cover up the first sin. Do you see the heart issue here? Different sins to David's, for many of us, no doubt, but this same tendency in our hearts. Once you make the decision, once we make the decision, I'm going to cover this up, it's a downward spiral. Because the attempts to cover up just lead to further sin. Now, perhaps we do that. We can all think ourselves into this situation because it's true of all of us in different ways. We do it, I guess, because of our reputation. Maybe it's outward respectability, not wanting to be truly known by others. And so we'd rather cover up, duck and hide, as it were, than be known for who we really are. Well, what happens if we keep on covering up? The passage continues. The attempts to appear outwardly respectable, they just become more and more extreme. So David's failed in his efforts to get Uriah to go home to his wife. So now he decides, I'll try a different tack. He's going to get rid of him. And he's desperate enough not to be found out that he even draws his own nephew, his military commander Joab, into the wickedness. Verse 14, in the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it with Uriah. In it, he wrote, "Put Uriah out in front where the fighting is fiercest, then withdraw from him. So he will be struck down and die." I mean, how wicked is that? You plot the murder, getting someone else to do the dirty work, and you get the guy who's going to be murdered to take the letter with him back to the person who's going to do it. Now, we don't know how Joab felt about receiving this order. Presumably, he had his reservations. But again, unable to resist the power and balance of the king. So verse 16. So while Joab had the city under siege, he put Uriah at a place where he knew the strongest defenders were. When the men of the city came out and fought against Joab, some of the men in David's army fell. Moreover, Uriah the Hittite died. And so again, cover up leading to more sin. We got murder, the needless death of other men in the army added to the rape and the deceit. Joab has to join in with the deceit. He sends this kind of message, this duplicitous report back to David with all these instructions about if David gets angry, make sure to tell him that Uriah is dead. If he gets angry about you, why you got so close to the wall. So now Joab's in on the cover-up as well. And then we get this just sort of dripping with hypocrisy moment. So David pretends to be ever so compassionate and caring. The news comes to him. The essence of the message he gives back to the messenger in verse 25 is, it's okay, Joab. Things like this happen in war. Don't worry about it. Don't be discouraged. Keep going. Words dripping with hypocrisy, giving the messenger this impression that he's so kind and understanding and caring for Joab. And all the while, he's spinning this tale to cover up. And then the final insult, he takes Bathsheba to be his wife. He just waits until just after the morning, then brings her to be his wife. And we can guess why. The pretext of lovingly providing for her, caring for this widow, and all the while thinking, well, if this happens soon, then 9 months down the line, people are going to think it's happened after I got married. Staggering levels of hypocrisy. And all because covering up sin leads to more and more sin. Now, again, I get most of us probably haven't done anything like David here. That's not the issue, though. The issue is the similar tendency of the heart. I mean, ask yourself, why would David go to such extreme lengths to cover up? Why is that his tendency? Why is that our tendency? And we know the answer, don't we? It's because we actually can, like David, really cover up rather well for a time. If we try hard enough, our default tendency, our default setting, we would far rather hide the truth about ourselves than be genuinely known. And we can do that. For a time, we can do that. I just want to ask you this evening, as I've asked myself, if there are areas of your life where the fear of someone else's reaction is kind of causing you to cover up. Maybe you've been drawn into some pattern of life you just never expected to be in. I don't know, online gambling starts out small, grows and grows, and you fear telling the family out of a sense of shame. I say to you, please don't keep that hidden. Addiction like that is a terrible thing. We really feel for you. We really would love to walk alongside you and be honored to do that, to help you with that. That's a real struggle. Or it might be that that you've got caught in a web of pornography. You wish that wasn't the case, and you just don't feel able to say it, and not least to your other half, if you're in that position. And so you have to work harder and harder, don't you, to cover up your browsing history. Again, we're here. Please don't feel that you need to hide away in that struggle. This is a Lord of grace. And bringing things into light, we'll see more in next week, but bringing things into light is so helpful and so healing. Or maybe it's on a different level. You're just conscious that sometimes you find yourself saying things to other Christians, maybe it's after church, small group, give the impression that you're more devoted to the Lord than you really are. I know I have to watch that as a minister. Frankly, sometimes I end up saying some things to some of you that imply that I'm more prayerful or more devoted than, if I'm honest, I really am. See, as we cover up, it just leads to more sin. And yet we're all tempted to do it, aren't we? Because it feels like it's the easier path. Saving face in front of others. And actually, I wonder if you notice that at the end of this chapter, David is, He has not been found out, has he? He appears to have got away with it all. And that is where the chapter would actually leave us, with this sense that, well, sin actually can be covered up. Do you notice that God is not mentioned? This is a godly man who's been seeking after God for the last 10 chapters, but God is not mentioned once up to verse 26. If there's no God, well, you really can cover up sin. But then we get the final words of the chapter. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. Those final words change everything for David and for us. They show us, whatever our efforts with one another, we can't cover up sin from God. I wonder if you've ever had the experience that I have of thinking that you could quickly get away with something because you thought you couldn't be seen. Now, the embarrassment of a moment like that is still imprinted deeply on my memory. It feels a bit like counseling this evening, telling you. I was about 10 years old, and we were out for a walk with a family in the park, and I had one of those desperate to answer a call of nature moments. So I ran ahead from the family off into the trees. I found a suitable spot behind a tree. But as I stood there, I realized that it wasn't a suitable spot. Some old ladies who I hadn't spotted in my desperation to sort of find a place to be were in fact gradually walking towards me and at an angle that meant that the tree was not doing its job. So there I stood. Too late at this point to move, cringing inside. See, trying to get away with something because we think we can't be seen. It happens in the embarrassing moments like that. Maybe you've got your own. But we also try and do it with the more serious things in life. And as we've just said, King David, he's, as it were, in this chapter, trying to do that with God. It's as if he thinks that if he doesn't involve God, God won't see. He's living as if, really, as if he's a functional atheist, that God isn't there. And yet, God is there. And we get his verdict in those final words. The thing that David had done displeased the Lord. Actually, that's sort of slightly weak language. Literally, it means that the thing that he had done was evil in the Lord's sight. He's slidden further and further into sin. He's desperate to cover it up. And if God was not there, he might have succeeded. But God is there. He does see the sin. And he does care about it. In fact, he cares about it so much that very often he has his ways of bringing it out into the open in his timing. We're going to see that next week in the next chapter. And that's true for us too. Whatever this evening, whatever it is that we might be trying to hide, trying to mask from others, ultimately that's not the place to stay because, well, the Lord sees it. The Lord cares about it. And he often has his ways of bringing it into the open. We are very good at pulling the wool over one another's eyes, maybe for a very long time. But our true selves, how we actually live, that is not hidden from the Lord. And that means that right now, however we appear on the surface, God sees our hearts. He sees those things that happen when no one else is looking. We can't cover up sin from God. Well, I said earlier that at this point in 2 Samuel, we're left wondering how King David, the one who was carrying the hopes of a nation, could have fallen so far. And confronted with his fall and with the tendencies of our own hearts to cover up, to duck and hide. It's not a surprise if we're left feeling heavy by that. And actually, that would be a very, very heavy place to land if it weren't for the glorious truth, the glorious hint that we get in this part of 2 Samuel. You see, as we're confronted with King David's massive failure and our own wayward hearts, we're left looking for a different kind of king. Actually, if you're ever puzzling about how to read the Old Testament, it's great to look for the cues. Where's the one to come? And here we're left wondering. We're left waiting for a different kind of king. We find him, don't we, in the pages of our New Testament. Our Lord Jesus, the king in David's line, promised by God, but this time a faithful king, a sinless king. The New Testament is emphatic that Jesus, he never sinned. 2 Corinthians 5:21 says Jesus had no sin. And because he had no sin, he could deal with ours. He could deal with our tendency to compound the problem, to cover over the sin, to cover it up. He could deal with that because of his perfect, sinless life and his death in our place. The whole of that verse I just quoted, 2 Corinthians 5:21, it says, God made him who had no sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. That's saying that because of the perfect life of our sinless King Jesus, when we trust in him, we get his righteousness. God relates to us now, not on the basis of how we've lived, not on the basis of our covering up, but on the basis of Jesus' perfect life. We're treated by God as righteous, declared by him as righteous because of our Lord Jesus, our sinless King. And that means we can know this evening, despite all the sin, all the covering up, if I've trusted in the Lord Jesus this evening, then wonder of wonders, I am treated as righteous in God's sight. That is what you can say to yourself this evening. That is what God says to you this evening. He looks at you, put your name in this sentence. He looks at me, he says, John, sinner though you are, righteous. You can fill in your name there. Sinner though you are, righteous. We're going to continue to be reminded of that glorious truth, of a Lord who covers all our sin, of a Lord who declares us righteous after all the covering up. I'm going to do it as we come in a few moments to take the Lord's Supper. But first we're going to hear someone speak of their experience of the joy of being declared righteous in God's sight. So if we can have the video, please, Jono.
Thanks for listening to the Emmanuel Croydon podcast. For more information about our church and everything we have going on, visit our website, emmanuelcroydon.org.uk. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram to see and hear what's going on in the life of our church. God bless you and have a wonderful week.